Good morning. Again, I'm Adam Meyerson. I'm president of the Philanthropy Roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us. The field of philanthropy has changed in three important ways since the roundtable was started 20 years ago. First, there is much more attention to defining and protecting philanthropic intent, especially among new donors. Second, there is an explosion of new services and networks providing information, analytic tools, and collaboration opportunities to donors to help them make wise decisions. And third, the field is being rejuvenated by new donors who are applying to philanthropic questions. Their innovative entrepreneurial spirit, their understanding of strategy, and their passion for defining and measuring results. Our speaker this morning has been one of the great leaders in this transformation of philanthropy. Many of you know Bain & Company. It is one of the world's preeminent business consulting firms. Mitt Romney, incidentally, was a vice president at Bain before co-founding Bain Capital. Tom Tierney joined Bain in 1980 and served as chief executive from 1992 to 2000, presiding over a six-fold increase in the firm's revenues. And for the last dozen years, he has been chairman and co-founder of Bridgespan, a nonprofit offshoot of Bain that applies Bain's business consulting principles to philanthropy and nonprofits. Earlier this year, Tom and his co-author Joel Fleischman published an outstanding book, Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. It is the best short book on effectiveness in philanthropy that has ever been written. And Bridgespan has generously made copies of Give Smart available for all annual meeting participants. We're honored that Tom is speaking at three separate sessions at this conference. This one we don't expect to have a baby announced during the... But we're really honored to have him with us at this annual meeting. Please join me in welcoming Tom Tierney.
Thanks, Adam. That was pretty special last night. Question, how many of you ever give money away? Ever give money away? How many of you volunteer time, precious time, to serve in some way? What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? You're making some funny choices. You know, in my own cases, as Adam mentioned, I left this job. We bought Bain & Company for a dollar in a bunch of debt in a management buyout in 1991 led by Mitt Romney. Mitt then went back to Bain Capital. I collaborated with him for the first couple of years. I took over as chief executive. We were lucky to turn the thing around. The way you can grow something sixfold, by the way, is to start really low. We got down to 3 weeks of cash, which I will never, ever forget in my entire life. It's a defining experience to have 3 weeks of cash and about 1,000 employees. Anyhow, the thing took off eventually through my help, but a lot of great people's leadership. And then I started thinking about service. I started asking myself, is this the answer? Is this what I want to do? Is there more? I love business. I love Bain. My partners finally accepted me as something more than overhead. But I made a choice. I made a choice to leave this company, at that time 2,200 people in 30 countries, and help launch a charity with three of us in a cubicle for no compensation. And we all make choices. It's sort of like there's some kind of philanthropic mad cow disease going around, where on one hand, we work so hard for our money and our time is so precious, and yet we give it away. We give it away. A voluntary decision, a personal choice. What's going on? Is this an unnatural act? Of course not. All the great religions have embedded in them this idea of helping. This country, America, there is not another country in the world that is anchored in the notion of lending a hand, private service, lending a hand to those in need. This is the great asset of this country, the notion of philanthropic freedom, the freedom to use my scarce resources, hard-earned, my time, in a way that I want to, in service of others. Now, this philanthropic freedom, which we all embrace, has a tiny little catch. And most of us don't think about it very often. And the catch is this. You need to choose what you want to accomplish with your philanthropy. It's a choice. You say, gosh, Tierney, that's a dumb thing to say. Of course I want to give money away and have something happen. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But there's something else going on here. And that is that this idea of exactly what's in first place when you think about what you want your philanthropy to accomplish is a fundamental decision every time you engage in philanthropy. Let me give you an example. Last week I had a conversation with a family on the telephone, three generations, have a foundation, a rather large foundation. You probably know the family. They were talking to Bridgespan about could Bridgespan possibly help them with their, quote, strategy. And I asked the question, I said, which is more important, family harmony and happiness or generating results? And they said, oh, no, it's family harmony. Family harmony is what matters here. We want to do some other things, but family harmony, not strategy. So that's their choice. That's their free choice. Had another family. This was an offside. Did this as a favor. We don't like doing these things. A very wealthy gentleman, founder of a company. 30 years later, he's cashing out. He's going to fund this enormous foundation. He has an offsite meeting with he and his wife and his three adult children and their lawyer. Asked me to come as a favor to talk to them about this. So over dinner and over quite a bit of wine, I finally asked, what do you want to accomplish with this? And he got all teary. And he said, I've been absent from my family for 30 years. I want to bring my family together. I want my children to know me. And I do not want to do any harm with the money. That's his choice, his free choice. We had dozens of people help us with the book in various forms and read it. And one friend of a friend emailed back after reading a draft and said, whoever wrote this book does not know a thing about philanthropy. Does not know a thing about the foundation world. My co-author, Joel Fleischman, I might not know much. He actually knows a lot. Said they don't know anything. This has nothing to do with results, philanthropy to get results. My philanthropy is about my children's self-esteem. It's about helping my kids understand their role in the community, educating them. That was his choice. There are lots of kinds of choices you can make, motives you can have behind your philanthropy. They're not mutually exclusive. Some people give to create a legacy. Some people give for recognition. Some people give, I give, it feels good. It feels good to give to others. All of those are perfectly legitimate and perfectly understandable and perfectly human characteristics. But what's missing? What about what you actually want the money to accomplish? Results. Now you might say, gosh, we want to do both. Well, you can't do both at the same level. Something's in first place. If you want to make everybody in your family happy, then you give them all money to do what they want. If you want to have more results, generally you need some sort of strategy that's a little bit more focused. So there are trade-offs involved in this motive. Trade-offs about how you make decisions that are real life and real pragmatic. The fundamental reality in philanthropy is that results are a choice. They're a choice. They're not a choice you have to make all the time. You can have a portfolio and choose results over here and choose recognition or giving back or feeling good or something else over there. But at least once in a while, if what you want is to change society, if what you want is to solve problems, is to achieve outcomes in certain ways, that has to be in the pole position. Everything then works back from there. We wrote Give Smart for philanthropists for whom in some of their giving at least results was in that pole position. That was what they wanted to achieve, more than some of these other things. And these other things might still be there, because it's not 100%, 0%, but it maybe results are 70 and these other things are 30, as opposed to the other way around. The fact is, philanthropy is very heartfelt. And so, of course, your heart is going to be embedded in your philanthropy. But what about the brain? The brain needs to be embedded also, just as much as the heart. And a little bit, this is the tug between the brain and the heart. Bridgespan was formed for only one reason. And myself and my 200 colleagues are there for only one reason, because we could all be doing other stuff. We're there because we believe philanthropy and nonprofit organizations in America can improve their performance quite dramatically. And that's what we want to be helpful at doing. We're not there for any other reason other than helping others improve performance, generate more results. So that's our singular focus in our work, in our research, in our publishing, in our web content, everything. Now, this observation that results is a choice has led to a little bit of attention inside the media. One of the phrases that we used in the book that we believe, my co-author and I, quite adamantly, is that the natural state of philanthropy is underperformance. It's the natural state of philanthropy is underperformance. On average, we could do better. Now, why is that? What's the root cause of that? Well, the first root cause is the one I've already described. Results are a choice. And you don't always choose results. I was fortunate to get into UC Davis, which was not a layup for me. And I was even more fortunate to get out of UC Davis, having studied agriculture and done a bunch of other things. So I feel an affinity to UC Davis. My wife and I, you know, I give them a little bit of money, what we can. I'm not expecting results. I'm doing it because that changed my life in a way. It changed my life. But other things, Peter last night was talking about Catholic schools in Boston. We've been supporting that for 18 years. That's about results. That is all about results. So you can choose these things. Results as a choice is the first root cause of this underperformance. The second one is even more profound. And the phrase we use is excellence is self-imposed. Excellence in philanthropy, actually in lots of things in life, but especially in philanthropy, is self-imposed. Well, what does that mean? In business, and I didn't understand this. You know, it's been 12 years. I'm still learning. Invite me back 12 years from now. I'll be smarter. But in business, you have to get better. If you don't get better, you go away. You just do. American manufacturing, as part of what's happening in, or has happened in American manufacturing, is we did not get better at the same rate our competitors got better. If we all started a restaurant and that restaurant wasn't competitive and didn't continue to improve, didn't attract customers, we'd be out of business. In philanthropy, there are no markets. There are no market signals. It doesn't mean there aren't muted market signals, there aren't some sorts of feed. There are some, but not many. And there are no direct consequences. What happens if donors give away money that basically is squandered? Anything happen to the donor? Nope. What if they work hard and get great results? Anything happen to the donor, personally? No. There are no consequences at all. It is unusual to create a situation where almost whatever you do, people praise you with happy talk. We love that grant. Was the grant you gave me, that was the best grant. Can I have some more? Can I have some more money? When was the last time you made a grant to someone, you gave a substantial gift, and the person subsequently told you you wasted your money? Boy, that was really stupid giving that money to me. I'd never do that again. Of course not. There's all this happy talk and no market forces, no customers to say, heck with you, I'm going to go get my money someplace else. I don't want your money. That absence of market forces causes excellence to be self-imposed. It has this characteristic of philanthropy that you just don't see anyplace else, which is a combination of Lake Wobegon, where everybody's above average, and the Galapagos Island, where there are no predators. So it's this blissful nirvana, which, by the way, you can actually have in perpetuity, which is a whole different notion. I was at a board meeting once, incredibly smart people. It was a foundation board. You know the board probably. Way smarter than me, big resumes, lots of PhDs and stuff like that. It's the end of the day. Everybody's tired. I was there as a guest. So could we change the topic a little bit? Tell me about what isn't working with your grantee base. What isn't working? In fact, let's be specific. Tell me about the grants that are in your bottom quartile. And one of the fellows, one of the most brilliant people in the room, immediately piped up and said, "We do not have a bottom quartile." This stunned everyone for a moment. The first recognition that maybe we don't have a bottom quartile, and then the recognition that they must have a bottom quartile, and then very quickly followed by the notion that they had no idea what was in it. Of course they have a bottom quartile. It's Lake Wobegon. Everybody's above average here. This trap of wishful thinking is the biggest trap in philanthropy. Excellence is self-imposed. If you don't impose that on yourself, you're going to fall in this trap of believing what you want to believe. Andy Grove wrote a great book, you know, Leader of Intel, Only the Paranoid Survive. It's hard to find paranoid philanthropists. You might be paranoid about the government, but paranoid about your results, boy, oh boy, that's hard to find. Yet in business, that paranoia exists everywhere. Tonight you're going to hear from an old friend and colleague, Mae Whitman. I've been on eBay's board now for, 8 or 9 years. If you're in that kind of a business today, you're paranoid every single day if you're in a web business. My guess is she's a little anxious right now about HP, too. You can ask her. But you don't sit on your laurels. You set your own bar and move fast. So in philanthropy, this notion of disciplined thought and disciplined action that Jim Collins proposes is enormously important. And here's a little footnote, and it's just a footnote. Then when it comes to imposing excellence, people seem to do that better when they're giving away their own money. Just a note. When you're giving away somebody else's money, the bar does not seem to be quite as high. Rest with that. What does it mean to confront, what does it mean to set your own bar? To impose excellence on yourself in this Lake Wobegon-ish space that where we try to be of service to others. It means first and foremost confronting tough questions. Give Smart is organized around questions. Because philanthropy is personal, it cannot be proscriptive. But as Einstein said, questions are more important than answers. There are questions that can help each of us address what we want to achieve with our own philanthropy. The first question is deeply personal. It's the hard question. What are my values and beliefs? That's different for everybody. Nobody can tell you what your values and beliefs are or how you want to act on those. That's the heart question. The other questions are head questions. What is success? And how are you going to achieve it? What's an A? The more clarity around that, the better. Fuzziness around that, bad news. The third question, what am I accountable for? Accountability in philanthropy. Accountability. I'm going to do something. I'm going to sign up to do it. And darn it, I'm going to get it done. The second three questions are all execution questions. Questions about what does it take to get the job done, which is a question around capacity. How do I work with grantees, and am I getting better? Those questions are all interacted. They're all connected. Sometimes they don't matter very much. When I'm giving money to UC Davis, those questions don't matter. Other times they matter a lot. If you're placing a big bet in a really complex situation, take K through 12 education or something, they may matter a lot. So let me shift and say, okay, how is it philanthropists seem to achieve excellence? Setting the bar high. Now this is where what little engineering I had comes into play. There's a notion of pattern recognition, where if you go back in time and you have enough data, you can start to see patterns. Some people are geniuses at this. My co-author Joel Fleischman, in his late 70s, there's probably no one in America, well, very few people anyway, who have studied philanthropy as much as he has. In a historic basis. He wrote a book called The Foundation. It's accompanied by a case book that has 100 cases of success stories for mostly 20th century philanthropy. So we teamed up because Bridgespan was born in the 21st century. He's done massive work in the 20th century. We wanted to look for patterns. One of the most enjoyable parts of the book to write was a hypothetical lunch between Andrew Carnegie and Bill Gates. hypothetical lunch. And so we know something about the Gates Foundation and the family and the philanthropy, and Joel Fleischman has studied Andrew Carnegie extensively. So we imagined this lunch, and it turns out they have a lot in common. In fact, one of the most interesting tidbits, of course, is Carnegie built libraries, and Bill Melinda's first major philanthropic effort was wiring libraries. But beyond that, we were looking in the book and in the research for what hasn't changed. What are, if you will, the timeless truths and the patterns? And so here are four patterns. Four patterns that seem to be correlated with philanthropic results. Number one, I've already alluded to. Ask the tough questions. Ask the tough questions. You will not raise the bar unless you're asking the tough questions of yourselves, of those people you give money to. Beware complacency. Beware wishful thinking. This is where, if it's your own money, you're more prone to ask those tough questions. I'll tell you a story. It's one of my favorite stories. It's 1952. Maybe it's 1953. It's a dark night. It's a dark night somewhere in New Jersey. And John and Nell Dorr, John's an engineer, Nell's his wife. John is a little engineering company. They started a little foundation. It's not much money. And they're driving down the road. And I suspect it was Nell, because she's on the passenger side. John's driving. John starts veering off onto the shoulder. And she says, honey, you know, we're getting in the dirt here. Move back. And on that dark night, they had an idea. They said, what if there was a line? What if there's a little line? A little white line. So the headlights could pick up the edge of the road before we get into the dirt, into the ditch. John, being an engineer, thought this was a great, it took them 2 years. They got to a test on the Merritt Parkway. 38 miles. $150 a mile it cost them to get the highway department to put this line on. Accidents down 52% in 3 months. They did another test in New York State. Accidents down 57%. They spent 10 years and a few hundred thousand dollars, highway departments around the country running these tests. You try to find a road today in America that doesn't have that white line. How many people are alive today because of that white line, because of John and Nell Dorr? So, what are the lessons there? What are the patterns you can deduce from that? They were obsessive. They were asking those tough questions. Number two, time and influence matter more than money. It wasn't their $150 that made the difference. It was that they were hammering on this thing, hammering on this thing. He had a full-time job. She was out there. The pattern throughout the dozens, hundreds of examples Joel and I have, some in the book, many not in the book, are that by and large, if you're achieving results, time and influence matter more than money. One of the other lead examples in the book is KIPP Academy. Most of you are familiar with that. You know, Don and Doris Fisher. Remember how Don, you know, rest his soul, remember how he used to just push KIPP, that scorecard, that report card of theirs, visiting schools, championing, twisting other arms. If you were in a room with, you just look out. Just look out. It wasn't just the money. It was the voice. It was the influence. And there are, you know, many, many, many examples of that. So, second pattern, time and influence matter more than money. You saw that, by the way, last night with the Lynches. How engaged are they? They're not just writing checks. They're involved. You don't have to be involved heavily. You can serve on a board. You can help in a capital campaign. You can coach a chief executive. You can be a spokesperson. There are a lot of different ways to do this. They do not require 40 or 50 hours a week. Third pattern, really important. Fewer, bigger, longer. Throughout the research, you see accomplishments, philanthropic accomplishments being associated with people doing fewer things in a more significant way, time and money, for a longer period of time. The moral, don't dabble. Don't dabble. You can dabble if you want to feel good and look good and give money around. That's fine. It's fine to do a bunch of that stuff. But if you want results, you need to focus on something. Maybe you can focus on multiple things. But you can't focus on dozens of things. Even if you have boatloads of dough, there are only so many hours in a day. If time and influence matter more than money, you can only exert that time and influence in so many different locations. So pattern number three, fewer, bigger, longer. Pattern number four, which all of you who are general managers or have general manager backgrounds will appreciate, is execution matters more than strategy. So Bain & Company is a strategy consulting firm. Bridgman got its start doing nonprofit and philanthropic strategy. I've got 30 years of training in that. Execution matters more. I didn't fully understand that until I took over running Bain. It's not about the playbook. It's about the players running the plays. So the back half of that book, about capacity building in these organizations, about getting the right people in the right jobs, about making sure the relationship with the grantees really work. We call relationships with grantees, by the way, often partnerships. That's not the grantee experience. It just isn't. In fact, in about a couple weeks, I'll be publishing a 35-page monograph that calls the donor-grantee trap. And it's how ineffective collaboration destroys results for society. And it does. People want leverage through their grantees or their philanthropy. Leverage being, I put a dollar in, I got $10 of impact. Yippee. Well, if you're not working well with your grantees, you put a dollar in and you get a dime out. A dime out. Or maybe 20 cents. But you don't really see it because the grantee isn't going to tell you that. It's all invisible. So this donor-grantee trap is a huge execution issue. The third question, am I getting better? Markets force us to get better. They force us to get better. If we're not getting better, we're getting worse. My first boss at Bain & Company, which he was an intimidating guy, he said, I just want you to know, Tierney, with me, every day you're either gaining or losing share. Just get your attention. Every day? How did I do today, boss? Up or down? Go, bad news. Well, with markets, that's actually true. You're either gaining or losing share. So excellence being self-imposed, probably the most important question in the book is, am I getting better? Because that forces you to say, where's my bar? How much am I, what am I clearing? How can I be 10% better? Let me close, and we'll have some time for a couple of questions, but let me close with a personal appeal. We launched Bridgespan 12 years ago, as Adam said. I spent 4 years before that kind of trying to figure out the social sector and raising money and getting the IRS, which was a huge pain in the tail, to approve what we were doing. So kind of been at this 16 years. So 16 years of analyzing trends in the social sector, participating as best as I was able to bring my gifts to it, in philanthropy and in nonprofits. And I have an observation. And the observation is this, when you track history, the observation is that right now, this decade, and maybe into the next decade, is a historic time. There has never been a civilization, as near as I can see in the history of the world, that has had the amount of private capital, and it's not just financial capital, it's human capital, which is dramatically more important, that has the wealth transfer, but that talent transfer coming together in service of society. The most profound trend in the social sector of the last 15 years has been an increased focus on results. Part of that's because donors are giving while living, they're getting engaged. Part of that's because people are repotting themselves. And we're going to hear from Jeff Rakes in a few minutes. 27 years at Microsoft, now he's in the social sector. His predecessor, Patty Stonecipher, same thing. Bill Gates, same thing. Pierre Omidyar, same thing. Many of you in this room I've talked to, same thing. People are not waiting to sort of learn, earn, serve, and serve at the back end of the career. Okay, I'm 7 years old now, I'll do something for society. No. We're getting started earlier in a more aggressive way. So historically, it looks like that right now in America, this decade, we have a profound opportunity to exercise philanthropic freedom, to do that intelligently and do that collaboratively and achieve results that we've never been able to achieve before. And by the way, a quick word from our sponsor. It's organizations like Philanthropy Roundtable, and maybe especially the Philanthropy Roundtable, that are helping people do that. They're actually helping people give smart. They're bringing people like all of you together. They're asking, how can we do this better? And by the way, how can we maintain our freedom to do it the way we want to do it? That's unbelievably important. We have this window of opportunity. Bridgespan is receiving 200 applications for every entry-level position. And these are applications from people in their 20s and 30s and people in their 50s and 60s and 70s. People who want to serve, who want to improve the state of the world. Since April, I've probably done 40 events with philanthropists around this country. Extraordinary people. And by the way, conservatives, liberals, I don't even know. But you know what? If you weren't reading the newspaper, I would say these people are amazing. They want to make things better. Most people want to make things better. And they want to do more with less. Because they're uncertain of their assets, but they see the problems. So my appeal, my ask, is a really simple one. Just aim 10% higher. You say, gosh, how could I achieve 10% better results? Choose results. And how could I achieve 10% better results? Just 10%. Because if you can achieve 10% better results next year than you did this year with whatever you're trying to accomplish, the year after that, you'll be up 10% again. And that magic of compounding will make the next generation for our kids a lot better. Thank you.